Chapter 23. Ornaments. The air in the room was just sufficiently warmer than outside to put a mist on the glass panes set in the red-painted casements, and the glass contained bubbles besides. But Catswain stood peering out as if she could see the dreary landscape clearly. She could see with more than enough clarity in any case. A few hapless folk, bundled and hatted, and only shapeless skirts or baggy breeches distinguishing men from women, were trudging the muddy fields that surrounded the manor house, sometimes stooping to feel a handful of the soil. It would not be long before they could begin their ploughing and manuring, but only their inspection indicated the coming of spring any time soon. Beyond the fields, the forest was all dark, bare branches against a washed-out gray morning sky. A good coating of snow would have made the view much less bleak, but it snowed lightly and seldom here, with traces of one fall rarely lasting until the next. Still, she could think of few places better for her purposes, with the spine of the world little more than a day's hard ride to the east. Who would think to look inside the borders of Tyr? Had convincing the boy to stay here been too easy, though? With a sigh, she turned from the window, feeling the golden ornaments hanging in her hair sway, the small moons and stars, birds and fish. She was very aware of them of late. Aware? Faw! Of late she had considered sleeping with them in place. The sitting room was large but not ornate, like the manor house itself, with cornices of carved wood painted red. The furniture was bright with paint, but not a touch of gilding. The two long fireplaces, plain stone, if well made, the andirons, sturdy, wrought metal, made for long service rather than appearances. The fires on the hearths were small, at her insistence, the flames flickering low on half-consumed splits. But either was enough to warm her hands, which was all she wanted. Left to his own devices, Algarin would have surrounded her with blazing warmth and smothered her in servants, few as he still employed. A lesser lord of the land, he was far from wealthy, yet he paid his debts in letter and spirit, even when most other men would have seen quite the reverse of a debt. The uncarved door to the hall creaked open. Most of Algarin's servants were nearly as old as he, and though they kept everything dusted and neat, the lamps topped with oil and the wicks trimmed, hinges in the manor seemed to escape regular oiling. The door creaked open to admit Verin, still dressed for a journey in simple brown wool with divided skirts, and carrying her cloak over her arm, still patting her gray-streaked hair into place. The stout little sister's square face wore a vexed expression, and she was shaking her head. "Well, the sea folk are delivered to Tyr, Catswain. I didn't go near the stone, but I heard that High Lord Astoril stopped complaining about his creaking joints and mustered inside with Darlin. Who'd have thought Astoril would stir himself and on Darlin's side? The streets are full of armsmen, most getting drunk and picking fights with each other when they're not fighting Atha an Mier. There are as many sea folk in the city as everyone else put together. Harina was aghast. She went rushing out to the ships as soon as she could hire a boat, expecting to be declared mistress of the ships and set everything to rights. There seems no doubt that Nesta Dinrias is dead." Catswain was content to let the round little woman chatter on. Verin was not nearly so vague as she pretended. Some Browns really were capable of tripping over their own feet from not noticing them, but Verin was one of those who wore an assumed cloak of unworldliness. She seemed to believe that Catswain accepted the cloak for reality, yet if there was a point to be made, she would make it. And what she left out might be revealing, too. Catswain was less sure of the other sister than she might have wished. Uncertainty was a fact of life, but she was uncertain about entirely too many things to suit her. Unfortunately, Min must have been listening at the door, and that young woman had little patience. "I told Harina it wouldn't be like that," she protested, bursting into the room. "I told her she'd be punished for the bargain she made with Rand. Only after that will she become mistress of the ships, and I can't say if it will be 10 days from now or 10 years. Slim and pretty and tall in her red-heeled boots, with dark ringlets hanging to her shoulders, Min had a low, womanly voice, but she wore a boy's red coat and blue breeches. The coat was embroidered with colorful flowers on the lapels and up the sleeves, and the breeches in bands down the outsides of the legs, but they were still coat and breeches. "You may come in, Min," Cadswain said quietly. It was a tone that usually made people sit up and take notice, those who knew her at all, anyway. Spots of color appeared in Min's cheeks. "The Wave Mistress has already learned all she is going to from your viewing, I fear. But from your urgency, perhaps you've read someone else's auras and wish to tell me what you saw?" The girl's peculiar ability had proved helpful in the past, and doubtless could again. Perhaps. As far as Cadswain could tell, she did not lie about what she saw in the images and auras that she perceived floating around people, but it was not always forthcoming, either. Particularly not when it came to the one person Cadswain would have liked to know about above all others. Red cheeks or no red cheeks, Min raised her chin stubbornly. She had changed since Shadar Logoth, or perhaps it had begun earlier, but either way, the change was not for the better. "Rand wants you to come see him. He said to ask, so you needn't get snippy over it." Cadswain merely looked at her and let the silence stretch. "Snippy? Definitely not for the better." "Tell him I will come when I am able," she said finally. "Close the door firmly behind you, Min." The young woman opened her mouth as if to say something more, but at least she retained sense enough to leave it unsaid. She even made a passable curtsy, in spite of those ridiculous boots, and shut the door firmly behind her, just barely short of slamming it, in fact. Varin shook her head again, giving a laugh that sounded only slightly amused. "She's in love with the young man, Cadswain, and she's tucked her heart in his pocket. She'll follow that before her head, whatever you say or do. I think she's afraid he almost died on her, and you know how that can make a woman determined to hang on." Cadswain's lips thinned. Varin knew more about that sort of relations with men than she did. She had never believed in indulging with her own warders, as some greens did, and other men had always been out of the question. But the brown had hit close to a truth without knowing. At least Cadswain did not think the other sister knew Min was bonded to the Al-Thor boy. She herself only knew because the girl had let too much slip in a careless moment. Even the tightest muscle eventually yielded its meat once you got that first small crack in the shell. Sometimes it gave up an unexpected pearl as well. Yes, Min would want to keep the lad alive whether she loved him or not, but no more than Cadswain did. Draping her cloak on the tall back of a chair, Varin moved to the nearest fireplace and stretched out her hands to warm them in front of the low flames. You could not say that Varin glided, but she was more graceful than her bulk suggested. How much of her was deception? Every Aes Sedai hid behind various masks over time. It became habit after a while. "I believe the situation in Tyr may be resolved peacefully yet," she said, peering into the fire. She might have been talking to herself, or wanted Cadswain to think it. "Herna and Siman are growing quite desperate, afraid the other High Lords will return from Ilion and trap them in the city. They may be amenable to accepting, darling, given their other choices. Estanda is made of sterner stuff, but if she can be convinced, there's advantage for her in it."
"I told you not to go near them," Cadswain broke in sternly.
The stout woman blinked at her in surprise. "I didn't. The streets are always full of rumors, and I do know how to piece rumors together and sift out a little truth. I did see Alana and Rafella, but I ducked behind a fellow hawking meat pies from a barrow before they saw me. I'm sure they didn't."
She paused, clearly waiting for Cadswain to explain why she had been told to avoid the sisters as well.
"I have to go to the boy now, Varin," Cadswain said instead. That was the trouble with agreeing to advise someone. Even when you managed to set all the conditions you could wish for, most of them anyway, you still had to come sooner or later when they called, eventually. But it did give her a reason to evade Varin's curiosity. The answer was simple. If you tried to solve every problem yourself, you ended by solving none. And with some problems, how they were solved really did not matter in the long run.
but not answering left Varen with a puzzle to ponder, a little butter for her paws. When Kedswain was unsure of someone, she wanted them unsure of her, too. Varen gathered up her cloak and left the room with her. Did the other woman mean to accompany her? But outside the sitting room, they encountered Nasuna walking briskly down the hall. She came to a sudden halt. No more than a handful of people had ever managed to ignore Kedswain, yet Nasuna did a credible job, her nearly black eyes latching on to Varen. "You're back, then, are you?" The best of Browns did have a way of stating the obvious. "You wrote a paper on animals of the drowned lands, as I recall." Which meant that Varen had. Nasuna recalled everything she had ever seen. A useful skill, if Kadzwain had been sure enough of her to make use of it. "Lord Algaran showed me the skin of a large snake he claims came from the drowned lands, but I'm convinced it is the same as I observed." Varen glanced helplessly at Kedswain over her shoulder as the taller woman drew her away by her sleeve, but before they were three steps along the corridor, she was deep in discussion over this fool snake. It was a remarkable sight, and troubling in a way. Nasuna was loyal to Elida, or had been, while Varen was one of those who wanted to pull Elida down, or had been. Now they talked amiably about snakes. That both had sworn fealty to the Althor boy could be laid to his being Taviran, winding the pattern around himself unconsciously. But was that oath sufficient to make them ignore their opposition over who held the Ammerlin seat? Or were they affected by having a Taviran in close proximity? She would have liked very much to know that. None of her ornaments protected against Taviran. Of course, she did not know what two of the fish and one of the moons did, but it seemed unlikely they did that. It could have been as simple as Varen and Nasuna both being brown. Browns could forget everything else when they settled to study something. Snakes. Faw. The small ornament swayed as she shook her head before turning away, leaving the two receding Browns behind. What did the boy want? She had never liked being an advisor, necessary or not. Drafts along the corridors rippled the few tapestries on the walls, all in old styles and showing the wear of having been taken down and rehung many times. The manor house had grown like a rambling farmhouse rather than being built large, with additions added whenever the family's fortunes and numbers waxed. House Penda alone had never been wealthy, but there had been times they were numerous. The results showed in more than worn, old-fashioned wall hangings. The cornices were brightly painted, red or blue or yellow, but the hallways varied in width and height, and sometimes met at a slight skew. Windows that once had looked to the fields now looked down on courtyards, usually bare except for a few benches, and placed purely to provide light. Sometimes there was no choice in getting from here to there except to take a roofed colonnade overlooking one of those courtyards. The columns were wooden more often than not, though bravely painted, even where not carved. On one of those walkways, with fat green columns, two sisters were standing together watching the activity in the courtyard below. At least they were watching together when Kedswain opened the door to the colonnade. Beldane saw her step out and stiffened, twitching at the green-fringed shawl she had worn fewer than 5 years. Pretty, with her high cheekbones and a slight tilt to her brown eyes, she had not yet achieved agelessness, and looked younger than Min, particularly when she shot Kedswain a frosty stare and hurried from the colonnade in the other direction. Maurice, her companion, smiled after her in amusement, shifting her own green-fringed shawl slightly. Tall and usually quite serious, with her hair drawn back tightly from her pale face, Maurice was not a woman who smiled often. "Beldane, she is becoming concerned that she has no warder yet," she said in the accents of Terabon as Kedswain stopped beside her, though her blue eyes returned to the courtyard. "She seems to be considering an Ashaman, if she can find one. I told her to talk to Daigyan. If it does not help her, it will help Daigyan." All of the warders they had with them were gathered in the stone-paved yard, in their shirt sleeves, despite the cold, most seated on painted wooden benches, watching two of their number work with wooden practice swords. Jahar, one of Maurice's three, was a pretty, sun-dark young man. The silver bells fastened to the ends of his two long braids chimed with the fury of his attack. He moved like a striking black lance. Not a breath of breeze stirred, but the eight-pointed star, like a golden compass rose, seemed to shift against Cadswain's hair. Had it been held in her hand, she could have felt it vibrating clearly. But then she already knew that Jahar was an Ashaman, and the star would not have pointed him out, merely told her that a man who could channel was nearby. The more men who could channel, the harder the star quivered, she had learned. Jahar's opponent, a very tall, broad-shouldered fellow with a stone face and a braided leather cord around his graying temples to hold back shoulder-length hair, was not the second Ashaman down there, but he was as deadly in his own way. Lan did not really seem to move that fast, but he flowed. His blade of bundled laths was always there to deflect Jahar's, always moving the younger man just a touch more out of his line. Suddenly, Lan's wooden blade struck Jahar's side with a resounding crack, a killing blow given with steel. While the younger man was still flinching from the force of the strike, Lan flowed back into a ready stance, long blade upright in his hands. Nethan, another of Maurice's, rose to his feet, a lean fellow with wings of white at his temples and tall, if still a hand or more shorter than Lan. Jahar waved him away and raised his practice blade again, loudly demanding another go. "Is Daigyan still bearing up?" Cadswain asked. "Better than I expected," Maurice admitted. "She stays in her room too much, but she keeps her weeping private." Her gaze shifted from the men dancing their swords to a green-painted bench, where Varen's stocky, grey-haired Tomas sat next to a grizzled fellow with only a fringe of white hair remaining. Damer, he wanted to try his healing on her, but Daigyan refused. She may never have had a warder before, but she knows that the grieving over a dead warder is part of remembering him. I am surprised that Kuril would consider allowing it." With a shake of her head, the Taraboner's sister returned to studying Jahar. Other sisters' warders did not really interest her, at least not like her own. "Ashaman, they grieve as warders do. I thought perhaps Jahar and Damer merely followed the lead of the others, but Jahar, he says it is their way too. I did not intrude, of course, but I watched them drink in memory of Daigyan's young Eben. They never mentioned his name, but they had a full wine cup sitting for him. Basana and Nathan, they know they can die on any day, and they accept that. Jahar expects to die. Every day he expects it. To him, every hour is most assuredly his last." Cadswain barely refrained from glancing at the other woman. Maurice did not often go on at such length. The other woman's face was smooth, her manner unruffled, but something had upset her. "I know you practice linking with him," she said delicately, peering down into the courtyard. Delicacy was required in talking to another sister about her warder. That was part of the reason she stared into the courtyard, frowning. "Have you decided yet whether the Althor boys succeeded at Shadar Logoth? Did he really manage to cleanse the male half of the source?" Coriel practiced linking with Damer, too, but the Yellow was so focused on her futile efforts to reason out how to do with Sidar what he did with Sidine that she would not have noticed the Dark One's taint sliding down her throat. A pity she herself had not come to the shawl 50 years later than she had, or she would have bonded one of the men herself and had no need to ask. But 50 years would have meant that Norla died in her little house in the Black Hills before Cadswain Maladrin ever went to the White Tower. That would have altered a great deal of history. For one thing, it would have been unlikely that she would be in anything approaching her present circumstances. So she asked, delicately, and waited. Maurice was quiet and still for a long moment, and then she sighed. "I do not know, Cadswain. Saidar is a calm ocean that will take you wherever you want, so long as you know the currents and let them carry you. Saidin, an avalanche of burning stone, collapsing mountains of ice. It feels cleaner than when I first linked with Jahar, but anything could hide in that chaos. Anything. Kedzwain nodded. She was not sure she had expected any other answer. Why should she find any certainty about one of the two most important questions in the world when she could find none on so many simpler matters? In the courtyard, Lan's wooden blade stopped, not with a crack this time, just touching Jahar's throat, and the bigger man flowed back to his waiting stance. Nethan stood again, and again Jahar waved him back, angrily raising his sword and setting himself. Maurice's third, Basana, a short, wide fellow, nearly as sun-dark as Jahar, for all he was Kyrianan, laughed and made a rude comment about over-ambitious men tripping on their own blades. Tomas and Dahmer exchanged glances and shook their heads. Men of that age usually had given up taunting long ago. The clack of wood on wood began once more. The other four warders were not the only audience for Lan and Jahar in the courtyard. The slim girl with her dark hair in a long braid, watching anxiously from a red bench, was the focus of Cadswain's frown. The child would need to flash her great serpent ring under people's noses to be taken for Aes Sedai, which she was, if just technically. It was not only because Nynaeve's face was a girl's face. Beldane still seemed as young. Nynaeve bounced on the bench, always on the point of leaping up. Occasionally her mouth moved as if she were silently shouting encouragement, and sometimes her hands twisted as though demonstrating how Lan should have moved his sword. A frivolous girl, full of passions, who only rarely demonstrated that she had a brain. Min was not the only one to have thrown her heart and head both down the well over a man. By the customs of dead Malkyr, the red dot painted on Nynaeve's forehead indicated her marriage to Lan, though yellows seldom married their warders. Very few sisters did, for that matter. And, of course, Lan was not Nynaeve's warder, however much he and the girl pretended otherwise. Who he did belong to was a matter they evaded like thieves slipping through the night. More interesting, more disturbing, was the jewelry Nynaeve wore. A long gold necklace and slim gold belt with matching bracelets and finger rings, the gaudy red and green and blue gems that studded them clashing with her yellow-slashed dress. And she wore that peculiar piece as well on her left hand, golden rings attached to a golden bracelet by flat chains. That was an Angreal, much stronger than Cadswain's shrike hair ornament. The others were much like her own decorations, too, Turangreal and plainly made at the same time during the breaking of the world, when an Aes Sedai might find many hands turned against her, most especially those of men who could channel. Strange to think that they had been called Aes Sedai, too. It would be like meeting a man called Cadswain. The question... Her morning seemed filled with questions, and the sun not halfway to noon yet. The question was, did the girl wear her jewelry because of the Althor boy? Or the Ashaman? Or because of Cadswain Maladrin? Nynaeve had demonstrated her loyalty to a young man from her own village, and she had shown her wariness of him as well. She did have a brain when she chose to use it. Until that question was answered, however, trusting the girl too far was dangerous. The trouble was... Little these days did not seem dangerous. "Jahar is growing stronger," Maurice said abruptly. For an instant, Cadswain frowned at the other green. "Stronger?" The young man's shirt was beginning to cling damply to his back, while Lan appeared not to have broken his first sweat. Then she understood. Maurice meant in the power. Cadswain only raised a questioning eyebrow, though. She could not recall the last time she had let shock reach her face. It might have been all those years ago in the Black Hills when she began earning the ornaments she now wore. "At first I thought the way these Ashaman train The forcing had pushed him to his full strength already, Maurice said, frowning down at the two men working their practice blades. No, it was at Jahar she was frowning. Just a faint crinkle of her eyes, but she reserved her frowns for those who could see and know her displeasure. At Shadar Logoth, I thought, I must be imagining it. 3 or 4 days ago, I was half convinced I was mistaken. Now, I am sure I am correct. If men gain strength by fits and starts, there is no saying how strong he will become. She did not voice her obvious worry, of course, that he might grow stronger than she. Saying such a thing would have been unthinkable on many different levels, and while Maurice had become somewhat accustomed to doing the unthinkable, most sisters would faint at the very idea of bonding a man who could channel. She was never comfortable giving them voice. Catswain was, yet she kept her voice neutral. Light, but she hated being delicate. Hated the necessity, anyway. He seems content, Maurice. Maurice's warders always seemed content. She handled them well. He is in a fury of... The other woman touched the side of her head, as though fingering the bundle of sensations she felt through the bond. She really was upset. Not rage, frustration. Reaching into her green worked leather belt pouch, she took out a small enameled pin, a sinuous figure in red and gold, like a snake with legs and a lion's mane. I do not know where the Al-Thor lad got this, but he gave it to Jahar. Apparently for Ashaman, it is akin to attaining the shawl. I had to take it away, of course. Jahar, he is still at the stage where he has to learn to accept only what I say he can. But he is so agitated over the thing. Should I give it back to him? In a way, it would come from my hand, then. Cadswain's eyebrows began to climb before she could control them. Maurice was asking advice about one of her warders? Of course, Cadswain had suggested she sound the man out in the first place, but this degree of intimacy was unthinkable. Faw. I'm sure whatever you decide will be correct. With one last glance at Nynaeve, she left the taller woman stroking the enameled pin with her thumb and frowning down into the courtyard. Lan had just defeated Jahar once more, but the young man was squaring up again, demanding yet another match. Whatever Maurice decided, she had already learned one thing she did not like. The boundaries between Aes Sedai and warders had always been as clear as the connections. Aes Sedai commanded and warders obeyed. But if Maurice, of all people, was dithering over a collar pin, Maurice, who managed her warders with a firm hand, then new boundaries would have to be worked out, at least with warders who could channel. It seemed unlikely that bonding them would stop now. Beldane was evidence for that. People never really changed, yet the world did, with disturbing regularity. You just had to live with it, or at least live through it. Now and then, with luck, you could affect the direction of the changes, but even if you stopped one, you only set another in motion. As expected, she did not find the door to the Al-Thor boys' rooms unguarded. Olivia was there, of course, seated on a bench to one side of the door with her hands folded patiently in her lap. The pale-haired Shanshan woman had appointed herself the boy's protector of sorts. Olivia credited him with freeing her from a Damani's collar, but there was more to it than that. Min disliked her, for one thing, and it was not the usual sort of jealousy. Olivia hardly seemed to know what men and women did together. But there was a connection between her and the boy, a connection revealed in glances that carried determination on her side, and on his, hope. Hard as that was to believe. Until Cadswain knew what that was all about, she intended to do nothing to separate them. Olivia's sharp blue eyes regarded Cadswain with a respectful wariness, but she did not see an enemy. Olivia had a short way with those she considered the Al-Thor boys' enemies. The other woman on guard was much of a size with Olivia, but the two could not have been more different. And not just because Elza's eyes were brown, and she had the smooth, ageless look of Aes Sedai, where Olivia had fine lines at the corners of her eyes and threads of white almost hidden in her hair. Elsa leaped to her feet as soon as she saw Cadswain, drawing herself up in front of the door and wrapping herself tight in her shawl. "He is not alone," she said, frost rhyming her voice. "Do you mean to stand in my way?" Cadswain asked, just as coldly. The Andoran green should have moved aside. Elsa stood far enough below her in the power that she should not have hesitated, much less waited for a command, but the woman planted her feet, and her gaze actually grew heated. It was a quandary. Five other sisters in the manor house had sworn fealty to the boy, and those who had been loyal to Elida all stared at Cadswain as if suspicious of her intentions toward him, which raised the question of why Varen did not, of course. But only Elsa tried to keep her away from him. The woman's attitude reeked of jealousy, which made no sense. She could not possibly believe herself better suited to advise him, and if there had been any suggestion that Elsa desired the boy as a man or a warder, men would have been snarling. The girl had finely honed instincts there. Cadswain would have ground her teeth, had she been the sort of woman to grind her teeth. At the point when she thought she would have to order Elsa to step aside, Olivia leaned forward.
"He did send for her, Elsa," she drawled. "He'll be upset if we keep her out. Upset with us, not her. Let her in."
Elsa glanced at the Shanshan woman from the corner of her eye, and her lip curled in contempt. Olivia stood far above her in the power. Olivia stood well above Cadswain, for that matter. But she was a wilder, and a liar in Elsa's view. The dark-haired woman hardly seemed to accept that Olivia had been Damani, much less the rest of her story. Still, Elsa darted a look at Cadswain, then at the door behind her, and shifted her shawl. Plainly, she did not want the boy upset. Not with her. "I'll see whether he's ready for you," she said, very near to sullen. "Keep her here," she added to Olivia more sharply before turning to knock lightly at the door. A male voice called from the other side, and she opened the door just wide enough to slip in, pulling it shut behind her.
"You'll have to forgive her," Olivia said, in that irritatingly slow, soft Shanshan accent. "I think it's just that she takes her oath very seriously. She isn't used to serving anyone."
"Aes Sedai keep their word," Cadswain replied dryly. The woman made her feel as if her own way of talking were as quick and crisp as a Kyrianin's. "We must."
"I think you do. Just so you know, I keep my word, too. I owe him anything he wants of me."
A fascinating comment, and an opening, but before she could take advantage of it, Elsa came out. Behind her came Algarin, white beard trimmed to a neat point. He offered Cadswain a bow, with a smile that deepened the wrinkles of his face. His plain coat of dark wool, made in his younger days, hung loosely on him now, and the hair on his head provided a thin covering. There was no chance to find out why he had been visiting the Althor boy. "He will see you now," Elsa said sharply. Cadswain very nearly did grind her teeth. Olivia would have to wait. And Algarin. The boy was on his feet when Cadswain entered, almost as tall and broad-shouldered as Lan in a black coat worked with gold on the sleeves and the high collar. It was too much like an Ashaman's coat with embroidery added to suit her, but she said nothing. He made a courteous bow, ushering her to a chair with the tasseled cushion in front of the fireplace and asking whether she would like wine. That in the pitcher, sitting on a side table with two wine cups, had gone cold, but he could send for more. She had worked hard enough to force him into civility. He could wear any coat he wanted. There were more important matters he had to be guided in, or prodded, or pulled as need be. She was not going to waste time or talk on his clothing. Inclining her head politely, she declined the wine. A wine cup offered many opportunities: to sip when you needed a moment's thought, to peer into when you wished to hide your eyes, yet this young man needed watching every moment. His face gave away almost as little as a sister's. With that dark reddish hair and those blue-gray eyes, he could have passed for Aiel, but few Aiel had eyes that cold. They made the morning sky she had been staring at earlier seem warm. Colder than they had been before Shadar Logoth. Harder, too, unfortunately. They also looked weary.
Algarin had a brother who could channel, he said, turning toward a facing chair. Halfway into the turn, he staggered. He caught himself on an arm of the chair with a barked laugh, pretending he had tripped over his own boots. But there had been no tripping. And he had not seized Sidene. She had seen him stagger, doing that, or her ornaments would have warned her.
Kareel said he only needed a little more sleep to recover from Shadar Logoth. Light, she needed to keep the boy alive, or it had all been for nothing.
I know, she said. And since it seemed Algarin might have told him everything, she added,
I was the one who captured Imarin and took him to Tarvalen.
A strange thing for Algarin to be grateful for, in some eyes, but his younger brother survived being gentled for more than 10 years after she had helped him reconcile to it. The brothers had been close. The boy's eyebrows twitched as he settled into his chair. He had not known.
Algarin wants to be tested, he said.
She met his gaze levelly, serenely, and held her tongue. Algarin's children were married, those who still lived. Maybe he was ready to turn this piece of land over to his descendants. In any case, one man more or less who could channel hardly made any difference at this point, unless it was the boy who was staring at her. After a moment, his chin moved, the vestige of a nod. Had he been testing her?
Never fear that I'll fail to tell you when you're being a fool, boy.
Most people remembered that after one meeting she had a sharp tongue. This young man required reminding from time to time. He grunted. It might have been a laugh. It might have been rueful. She reminded herself that he wanted her to teach him something, though he did not seem to know what. No matter. She had a list to choose from, and she had only begun on it. His face might have been carved from stone for all the expression he showed, but he bounded to his feet and began to pace back and forth between the fireplace and the door. His hands were clenched in fists behind his back.
I've been talking with Olivia about the Seanchan, he said. They call their army the Ever-Victorious Army for a reason. It's never lost a war. Battles, yes, but never a war. When they lose a battle, they sit down and work out what they did wrong or what the enemy did right. Then they change what needs changing for them to win.
A wise way, she said when the flow of words paused. Plainly, he expected some comment.
I know men who do the same. Davram Bashir, for one. Gareth Bryn, Rodal Itteralda, Agilmar Jagad. Even Pedron Nile did when he was alive. All judged great captains.
Yes, he said, still pacing.
He did not look at her, perhaps did not see her, but he was listening. It was to be hoped that he actually heard as well.
5 men, all great captains. The Seanchan all do it. That's been their way for 1,000 years. They change what they have to change, but they don't give up.
Are you considering the possibility they can't be defeated? She asked calmly. Calmness always suited until you knew the facts. And usually after, too. The boy rounded on her, stiff-necked and eyes like ice.
I can defeat them eventually, he said, struggling to keep his tone civil.
That much was to the good. The less often she had to prove that she could and would punish transgressions of her rules, the better.
But...
He cut off with a growl as the sounds of argument in the hallway penetrated the door. A moment later, the door swung open, and Elza backed into the room, still arguing in a loud voice and trying to hold back 2 other sisters with her spread arms. Arion, her pale face flushed with color, was pushing the other green ahead of her physically. Serene, a woman so beautiful she made Arion look almost ordinary, wore a cooler expression, as might be expected from a white, but she was shaking her head in exasperation, and hard enough to make the colorful beads in her thin braids click together. Serene possessed a temper, though she normally kept it sealed away tightly.
Bartol and Rashan do be coming,
Arianne announced loudly, agitation thickening Ilion in her speech. Those were her two warders left behind in Kyrian.
I did no send for them, but someone did travel with them. An hour ago I felt them suddenly closer, and just now closer again. They're coming toward us now.
My Vitalian, he also is coming closer, Serene said. He will be here in a few hours, I think.
Elsa let her arms drop, though from the stiffness of her back she was still glaring at the two sisters.
My Feral will be here shortly as well, she muttered.
He was her only warder. It was said they were married, and Greens who married seldom took another warder at the same time. Cadswain wondered whether she would have spoken if the others had not.
I didn't expect it so soon,
the boy said softly. Softly, but there was steel in his voice.
But I shouldn't have expected events to wait on me, should I, Cadswain?
Events never wait on anyone, she said, standing. Arianne flinched as if she had just noticed her, though Cadswain was sure her face was as smooth as the boy's, and maybe as stony at that. What had brought those warders from Kyrian, and who had travelled with them might be problems enough to go on with, but she thought she had gotten another answer from the boy, and she was going to have to consider very carefully how to advise him on it. Sometimes the answers were thornier than the questions.